and welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We're here with Rob W. Hart, author of New York. Our sponsor this week is once again High Octane Damnation. This is their last week with us. And as usual, we'll talk a little bit about that at the end of the show. This is Renee, and I'm drinking a Kraken rum and SodaStream Coke Zero right now. And I feel like I need to tell you exactly what it is, because I didn't think that SodaStream Coke Zero was going to be like that great of a compliment to black rum, but it's seriously amazing. So I recommend that. Rob, how are you doing and what are you drinking?
I'm doing very well. I'm freezing because it's like pouring rain and suddenly dropped down to 40 degrees. I am drinking a very large glass of Bullet Rye.
Jessica?
So it was I got it as a celebration today for selling my second book.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about that. Definitely worth celebrating.
We are celebrating. Yeah. I'm celebrating. I went special to the Kroger and got some Blue Moon finally. They had their summer honey wheat out, and it's so good.
Ooh.
I don't normally do this type of thing, but I would like to dedicate this specific show to the nachos that I ate earlier for dinner, because they were amazing. This is a very special episode.
I don't know. I had really good nachos for dinner tonight, too.
Really?
So we might be at an impasse here.
Oh, no.
My wife's co-worker's husband just opened up a Mexican restaurant, and so we went out. It was their first night tonight, and the nachos were pretty badass.
Look, I read your book, and I took every claim that New York pizza is the only real pizza with a grain of salt. So I'm just going to tell you that living my entire life in California, I have sincere doubts about New York Mexican food. Because when I was on the East Coast, I had one good Mexican food meal in the entire 6 years I lived there.
Okay, I will in fairness cop to the fact that New York has a hard time with Mexican, and it's tough to find good Mexican. I was very pleasantly surprised tonight. If you are eating pizza outside of New York City, it is not pizza and should not be called such.
Okay, so
like Chicago pizza, like people call Chicago pizza pizza, and it's not. It shouldn't even be called that. There should be a new name for it. It should be like stupid fucking garbage pile of nonsense.
I agree with that. That is gross to me.
Yeah, I don't do Chicago style pizza either. But
Like with Chicago pizza, it was like, let's take everything that's like beautiful and magical and subtle about pizza and just start piling shit on it until we turn it into a complete, like, you know, monument to gluttony.
You know what it is?
That's America,
like
though, right?
It's like those terrible.
Well, yeah, it's actually like a completely Americanized version of pizza. America.
Right. It's like it's like a KFC double down or whatever with the two chunks of chicken instead of bread.
I thought that was just like Atkins.
No, that's disgusting. Like, there's not a proper word for what that is.
Okay, we need to move away from this conversation before we start talking about the taco waffle, because I can't talk about the taco waffle without getting
Okay.
Only good things. Okay. So we're going to be serious for a minute. Very serious times.
Yeah.
It's a serious show.
Yeah.
You have a new book coming out, New York, and it's going to be part of a series. And big announcement, we just learned today that the second book in that series has been picked up. So tell us a little bit about New York and the series that you have planned and all that.
Sure. So New York, I started writing it probably like 4 years ago, and I wanted to, and I started writing it for a couple of reasons. One is because I really like PI novels, but I wanted to write a private investigator who is like way at the beginning of his career before he even realized that he was probably going to be a private investigator one day. He just sort of did these jobs for people and, you know, was kind of a dumb kid looking for, you know, his own moral compass and still hadn't found it. I wanted to write a book about New York because I really love living here. And at the time, I was sort of struggling with whether or not I should leave, because I think the city wears on you. And I got to a point where I'm like, well, you know what? I'm going to write this book, and at the end of the book, if the protagonist leaves, I'm going to leave. If he stays, I'm going to stay.
Those are some high stakes.
Yeah, it really was. And it was a little rough because then I met my wife probably halfway through writing the book, and, you know, then it becomes a bigger decision when another person is involved. But, I ultimately stayed, even though the character leaves. Fortunately, it's not a spoiler to say that he leaves New York because the next book is set in Portland, which was part of the synopsis that went up today. But, the series idea, initially New York was planned to be a one-and-done book. And I figured, I'm going to write this and I'm going to move on and go do something else. And I really, really liked the character because he's this kid who really, really means well and is kind of an idiot, but he has a good heart. He's just sort of trying to figure out what his definition of right and wrong is and the kind of man that he's going to be. And I thought it would be kind of fun to just kind of follow him for a little while as he's sort of looking for his moral compass.
Right.
So the next book is going to be in Portland. I've got sort of the first four planned out. And I think that I doubt I would go past like five or six because I like the idea of a series with an ending. But every book in the series is going to explore a different subgenre. So New York is sort of like a hard-boiled, like, PI novel. The second one is going to be like a Western. Except how, like, Roadhouse.
In Portland.
In Portland. Well, and the initial idea was to set it in Austin, Texas. Then I was like, you know what? It's a lot weirder to set a Western in Portland. So I'm going to do it there because it felt like more of a challenge. The third one is going to be sort of set in a in the woods. But it's going to sort of have this feeling of like a jungle setting and like a war novel. And then the fourth one is going to be a spy novel, which I'm really excited about. And, you know, the challenge is to sort of play with the different genres, but sort of keep it grounded in some kind of reality so I don't, you know, completely alienate the reader along the way.
Along with what you said, Nick Corfin had our first listener question, and he said, how did you get the idea to write the genre-specific sequels to New York? Was that just, it sounded fun?
I honestly don't remember. I know I kind of got to a point where I was like, well, maybe I can turn this into a series. Maybe I can keep on following this character. I think it was, I knew that I wanted to do something in, I think it was because the idea started in Texas, and I think it might have been because last summer, me and my wife and two of our friends were in Eastern Europe, and we were in the Czech Republic and Poland, and I got this idea for a spy novel, and I really, really liked the idea, and I liked the idea of using this character in the spy novel. Because the general conceit is that the U.S. government can't properly train spies anymore because it's impossible to conceal anyone's identity. So they sort of approach people on the street and coerce them into doing, like, one-off missions. And he's sort of, like, the perfect person to do it because he's young and, you know, brash and kind of smart but also prone to violence. I was like, you know, he'd be perfect for that sort of thing. Well, if I'm going to write him into a spy novel, maybe I could just keep on doing novels with him. So I want to say that that had something to do with it, and I could be completely wrong because I feel like I'm just doing this whole thing by the seat of my pants. Like, it's really, really, it's hugely exciting. Exhibit A, the folks there are amazing, and they believe in me, and they're supportive, and they're so cool. I also think they're kind of crazy. Because they're like, oh, yeah, no, we totally trust you to write a second book. And I'm like, cool, I've spent 6 hours playing Titanfall today. Sorry.
My bad. Your trust was misplaced.
Oh. Yeah, so it's weird because it's weird because, you know, writing, it's it's something that starts as sort of like a calling and something that, you know, is sort of like ingrained in you and you have to do it and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But then it sort of turns into a job. And that's,
yes.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing or I'm not, you know, passing judgment on either side. I'm just saying it's sort of interesting how the whole process sort of resets itself. And all of a sudden you're writing, instead of like writing toward like maybe one day accomplishing, you know, a publication, you're suddenly writing toward a deadline, which is like weird and kind of intimidating and scary. Exciting, but, you know, scary.
I always think it's funny when, you know, like, you see every so often, like, writers trying to make writing sound, like, really, like, mystical. And they'll be like, you know you're a writer because you have to write. Like, you're driven to write. You can't not write. And it's like, then why do so many writers have such a big problem with procrastination? Riddle me that.
You know, I I've noticed this a lot of, like, especially writers who are starting out, like they write their first bio and it's like this kind of cutesy thing and it's like, I came out of the womb holding a pen, and it's like, no, you didn't, motherfucker. Like, that's not physically possible. And, you know, I
made the news.
Like, mystical, absolutely there's a mystical nature to it, because in a sense, like, it's fucking weird that, like, you're literally just sitting, like, making shit up and then someone actually, like, wants to pay you for that. Like, that's a really amazing and very cool thing, and not everyone can do it, and it's something to be celebrated. But
sure.
At the end of the day, you got to sit down and you got to write words, you know? You got to hit your word counts and you got to turn your stuff in. So
when I was a kid, they just said I was a liar most of the time, but then I was able to like keep those lies inside and write them down, and they said, "Oh, you're writing. You're creative.
You're a writer." Wow.
Yeah.
I'm so proud.
No, it's like the funnest job in the world, but it's still
is.
A job, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very excited about I think your third book, I guess, that isn't written, because you said it was going to be a war thing, and that really piqued my interest. I'm super excited, so make sure and keep doing it, and I'll buy that third one, no doubt.
You know, that one's going to be a lot of fun, because I'm sort of, also what I'm doing is I'm sort of like writing about places that I've been to that I really like. And so the third one is actually going to be set at a hostel. It's called The Hostel on the Forest. It's in Georgia, I think in like Brunswick. And my friend was the manager there, and we went down there for a couple of days a few years ago. And it was super fucking hippie, but like a lot of fun. And I thought it would be really cool to do something with that. Like that, I actually had a plan for a standalone novel. And then I figured out a way to make it work for this. And I was like, oh, cool. Yeah, I'm going to write about the hippies next.
So I have to ask this question, even though I know it's a smart-ass question because it's never stopped me before. Is the second one going to be called Portlanded?
No. The second one is going to be called City of Rose.
Of course, yeah.
Because Portland is the city of roses, and he's the protagonist is looking for a little girl named Rose. And there's something, and here's the thing, it's kind of cheesy and cutesy, but there's something, it's got this ring to it that I really, really like. So
yeah, no, it sounds nice.
Until someone tells me otherwise, I'm going to stick with that. Like, it was funny, when we sold New York, my editor was like, I don't like the title, we have to change it. I'm like, fuck no. Like, I like this title a lot. And I explained to him the significance of it, and he was like, oh, okay, I know, that makes sense, that's fine. And then
when I got to that part of the book, I was like, oh, that is so cool.
See? Yeah, it's in the book. It's like, it's a term that people use, and it's about how the city just fucks up things. And so my suspicion is that because my editor really liked the title for the second one, this is the one that he's actually going to make me change. So, but we'll see. At this point, it's like, I've got, you know, something close to like 10,000 words on it, and I cracked the story, which is the important thing. Like, I know where the story is going to go. So it's sort of a matter of actually turning off the Xbox and sitting down to work.
I'm so glad I never got into video games. Unfortunately, I got into like Facebook, which is worse. But so you're not an outliner then?
I pretend like I am, and then I throw out my outline. It's funny. So I'm in my office right now. It's in our house. It's in the attic, and the roof is eaved. So there's like over my computer, I turned there's sort of like this panel. I painted it with whiteboard paint. So I basically have this gigantic whiteboard over my computer, and
that's cool.
I outline on it, but then I leave the outlines up for so long that the paint sort of the markers become embedded in, and then I have to go like get a cleaner and then take it all off. And I'm looking at like the outline on it for right now is for like a completely different project plus notes for something else. And yeah, I pretend to outline, and then I just decide, you know what, fuck it, and then I just start writing. So it's
you just got me so
not
excited.
A very thoughtful process.
I'm moving, and when I move, I'm gonna finally have a dedicated office, and I'm gonna paint some freaking whiteboard paint in there.
Dude, get the whiteboard paint, but crack a window because you will get high as fuck. Like I. So the attic up here, there's two small windows and there's not a lot of cross ventilation. And when I painted it, like it came out really good. And, you know, my wife was like, oh, wow, like it looks really awesome. I'm like, yeah, it looks really cool. But why is Batman here dressed like a dinosaur? You know, like the fumes will get you.
That sounds terrifying.
That's good to know. I'm going to make a note of that. I want to go serious for a second, if that's okay.
No. I mean, yes. Okay.
Okay. So what I thought that was personally, like, for me, interesting was I'm not, I lived on the East Coast, but not in New York, not anywhere in the area, not in the state, right? So I went to New York a couple of times, but that's it. So what I noticed reading your book is, I guess, what is missing from everything else that's been written or filmed about New York since 9/11, which is that it's a part of this story.
Okay.
And it seems like a lot of the stuff that is written or filmed about New York now just sort of like kind of pretends it didn't happen, or like there's like one throwaway reference to it, whereas this, it's ingrained in the story. And to me, reading it, it was, even if I didn't already know, which I kind of do, that you're, you know, you love the city personally, it was obvious to me that this was written from a place of like a deep love and a deep respect for the city, and that it, like, it was more authentic, I guess, than a lot of the stuff you read that takes place in New York, where it's like, well, it's, you know, it's a generic city where city things happen. Whereas this really felt like a place that had a certain tone and a certain feeling, and that the people there were experiencing the things that we know people in New York experienced.
Yeah. You know, One of the many reasons that I wanted to write the book is because it's so hard. It was so hard for me personally to see something, whether it be a movie or a book or a television show, where the New York that I know is portrayed accurately. So this book is very much about the New York of my, like, early to mid-20s, when I was running around the East Village being an idiot and doing dumb shit. And but what goes in hand with that is, I think it's a difficult subject to write about, but it's dishonest to pretend like it's not ingrained in the identity of the city. You know,
right.
There are the city changed by a huge, huge, huge way afterward. And I do think you're right. I do think a lot of portrayals sort of whitewash it because it's hard to talk about, you know.
Right.
I mean, I had a crisis of conscience halfway through writing this. So my dad is a New York City firefighter, and he was okay. Like, he went there, but he came home, and that was fantastic. I spent the day not really sure if he was going to come home, which was pretty fucking miserable. A lot of his friends didn't come home, and that was rough. And I would never pretend like the sort of pain and the hurt that I felt afterward even comes close to what they felt. And I guess it's important to just clarify for the listeners right now that the protagonist of the book, his father was a firefighter who died on 9/11.
Right.
So he's carrying this like huge well of rage inside him that he can't direct at anyone or anything, which was really a lot of the problem afterward, is that everyone wanted to be angry, but there was no one to be angry at.
Right.
At least, like, not like a specific person. It was more just like a weird, like, idea of terrorism and some guy who was living in the mountains. But, I actually sat down and reconceived the book. I didn't rewrite it, but I sort of, like, took what I had and rebuilt it in, like, an outline format, stripping all of those details out. And I sat there looking at it for, like, a day or two, and I'm like, I can't tell this story the way I want to tell it if I sort of remove him from it. You know, like,
right.
I needed him to have that sort of, like, white-hot center of it, because the book, to me, was really about the cycles of violence and the choices that we make after these, like, big, horrible events that are impossible to understand. And, you know, I would never pretend like I could assign any meaning to it or say anything profound about it, but I still wanted to sort of talk about it a little bit. So
I think it was handled beautifully in the book. I know I do a lot of reading for the show in public places, because, you know, I mean, we have a new book every week, I was reading the flashback scene where he's talking about the morning of 9/11 and his mom and stuff like that. And I was at my daughter's gymnastics class, and I totally spaced out and was like completely like in it, goosebumps, like tearing up. And then I was like, oh my God, like it's the end of class. Like I'm supposed to be paying attention right now. And like, you know, being involved in what's happening, and I had to put it away. And it was weird, because it was like a sudden shift from being really involved in those strong emotions that you were conveying in the book to then like, okay, and now we're with a bunch of 4-year-olds getting like ribbons for gymnastics, you know? And the other thing, and I share it, like, I like pulled this quote out specifically. I loved it, is towards the latter, I guess, latter quarter of the book. The quote is, "Time is supposed to heal all wounds, which is a thing people say when they've never been cut to the bone. The big wounds, even when they do heal, they don't heal right. Every time you move, you feel the tug of the scar tissue." I thought that was profound. I think it's beautiful.
It's lovely, yeah.
Oh, Jesus, you're going to make me all, like, fucking weepy and stuff. I want you to understand something, and I mean this in a very deep and important way. It means a lot to me that you would say that and that you would sort of cite that, because that's, I remain really terrified of how people are going to react to this book, because it's something that people can be and should be sensitive about, because it's so big and so terrible. And the last thing that I ever would want to be accused of is sort of mining it for my own personal benefit, you know, or sensationalizing it or something. So hearing your reaction to that, because you're like, outside of like my wife and my editor and my agent and like 3 or 4 other people, you two are like the first to actually like consume the book and react to it in a public way. So this is really cool. And I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be, what, like, every once in a while we get someone's book, like, way early, and that's one of my favorite things. So, luckily, we usually have really great writers on the show, and it's not awkward. They're like, so, Rob.
We are so excited. So, yeah. Now I feel like we're having a really emotional moment.
I know. Well, and that's the thing.
I said to
Jessica, like, I feel like we need to talk about this portion of the book, but we have to kind of feel it out, because if it gets too serious, it could get weird. But I think, you know, it's like you said, you don't want to come across like you're exploiting it. However, it would be very, I think, disingenuous to leave it out.
Exactly.
And that's the thing is, when I was reading it, it really did make me think of, like, everything takes place in New York. Like, every freaking thing. And there's a couple lines about that in the book, too. And it's like, wait a minute. Like, when is the last time that I've even heard this event referenced? And it's not, like, it was a huge event in my life, and I grew up in California. So, obviously, if all these stories are taking place in New York, it's going to be a huge event for the people who live in New York.
Yeah, and it goes from, like, the big things to the little things, you know. I mean, my office is in Tribeca, and I walk from – every morning I walk from the Staten Island Ferry to my office, and I walk past Ground Zero every day, which now is a construction site. Shameful that it's still a construction site, but it is. And so I sort of – I see that part of it every day, like the guys who are, you know, walking around, like, trying to sell commemorative 9/11 journals to tourists and – you know, all the sort of frenzy that's going on down there. But then it's sort of like the little things, you know, like the controversy with the Muslim Community Center, which is, you know, still sort of ongoing. You know, I remember once a friend of mine was offering to do something kind of stupid, and someone was like, oh no, you're going to get the cops, you're going to get to. He's like, no man, you know, this is post 9/11 New York. We know how to handle the cops in this town. And I'm not phrasing it correctly, but it was sort of like the way the thought sort of trickles down into everything for the people who were here, or the people who were here during it. And it's weird because it's sort of become a part of the fabric now, and it's still there, but in a way that again goes back to what you were saying, that, like, you know, people will sort of pay it lip service and then sort of leave it where it is. I think that we're at a point right now, and I hope to see more instances of this. You know, I really do believe that stuff like this needs to be explored through art and artwork in order to contextualize it. And so I think we're sort of at that point now that we're more than 10 years out, that it gets a little bit easier. So, you know, hopefully there'll be a little bit more of that.
I mean, just wondering out loud, this is not anything I thought of before, so if what comes out is stupid, excuse me. But I do wonder if the delay in really facing it and talking about it and having it become part of our culture is part of the reason why it has been so easy for the things that have changed nationwide to change and remain changed, like, you know, the airport security and all the stuff, because it does sort of seem like it happened, and for several years after, once a year, everybody had to sit in front of the TV and cry over it, and then it's, like, slowly faded away, and now, like, people who are just a few years younger, I think we established before the show, you weren't here, Rob, that the three of us are all about the same age. People who are just a little bit younger than us, like, they don't even really have, like, a good grasp on what happened. And to them, post 9/11, America is where they've always lived.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, I read an article that said that a while back, and I was like, wow, like, that's crazy. And it's been for as long as I've been a legal adult, you know? So.
Well there's a couple of things that Americans are really good at. So. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The entire lifetime of my child, who is going to be 6 in September, we've just been at war, like, for his whole life. That blows my mind.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
It's like, well, the Americans are really, really good at ignoring shit. Right? We're fucking pros at ignoring shit. You know, it's I'm reading, I think the title is The Divide by Matt Taibbi. And it's about how the divide between how the rich can sort of literally do whatever they want, like the banks, you know, destroyed the U.S. economy and no one went to jail, and how you could be a black kid in Harlem and a cop needs to fill a quota, so he throws you in a van and arrests you. And, you know, that's a huge, horrible, terrible thing, and people should be in the street protesting about it. And instead, let's watch American Idol, you know? I mean, which is sort of like a very generic and pat argument to make. But, yeah, you know, we're good at ignoring things because we don't like thinking about bad things. So, and there's so many opportunities to distract us from bad things.
What I think is really interesting, too, is the bad things that we latch onto are so weird. Like this whole, is his name Ron Sterling? I wanted to say Rod Sterling, but that's the Twilight Zone guy, right?
Well, the
Clippers guy.
Yeah.
I never knew
who
he was because I don't follow basketball, right? But everybody's up in arms about it. And then you start hearing about, like, all the really terrible stuff he's been doing for, like, decades. And nobody ever said anything. But now that there's, like, a mistress involved and, like a salacious phone call, like, now everybody's got the pitchforks out. And the NBA's like, oh, well, we're going to have to take a stand against this. We can't have racism in the NBA, even though you've been a racist for a really long time. Like, it's, and I heard a couple people talking about it. Like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wrote something about it, and an ESPN anchor did an interview, and I was like, you know, they're making such an amazing point, whereas you feel like you're justifiably like, that guy's an asshole. But then you have to ask yourself, like, he's been doing this for a really long time, and even the NAACP gave him a fucking award. Like, where was all the coverage of this 10 years ago? Where was this, like, you know, housing discrimination is actually a huge thing. Like, people die over it. Why have we never heard of this guy before unless you watch the NBA? And everybody who pays attention to the NBA is like, oh, yeah, he's always been a dick. It's just really weird how we can, like, focus on, like, one bad thing and, like, feel really good about being angry about that thing and then, like, just sort of move on to the next big thing and not pay attention to all the stuff that's underlying.
Yeah, I think on one hand, it's sort of fashionable right now to be outraged about things. You know, like, and I stole this from someone, so I'm not going to claim credit, but someone referred to it as being professionally offended. And social media plays a big role in that. It gives the opportunity to people to be professionally offended about things, and that way you can know where they stand on issues, and you can know how they're such a good person because they hate that guy who's a racist or a homophobe or whatever. I don't know. Some days I go back and forth. Some days I think that the system is completely broken and we're just fucked, so I'm just going to pay attention to what I'm doing and keep my head down. And there are days that I really do feel like the human race is better than that, and we can persevere and we can succeed, and people are just getting too down on each other. So I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's a fine line, I think. You know, you have to take the good with the bad with anything, and especially humanity.
This is getting really deep.
It is. I was just going to say that. I was like, I feel like I've had too much to drink to continue on this line. I don't want us to, like, suddenly,
you know,
3 hours later, we're crying. Like,
I'm going to go into this because Renee said the weird thing about how we just found out we were all about the same age. Rob, we are so close to the same age. We both have December 82 birthdays, I found out in my research.
Are you serious? When is your birthday?
December 7th, the day that will live in infamy.
My sister is December 6th.
Really?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah.
No.
God, December birthdays are the fucking worst, man. Minus the 21st.
I know. That's harder. See, I still got, like, nobody confused me with, I'm far enough away that Christmas didn't get affected by my birthday.
I like that you said nobody confused me with, like, you were going to be like, nobody ever confused me with Jesus.
Nobody. They did, in fact. That was
I've gotten a lot of birthday presents and Christmas wrapping paper.
Yeah, that's tough.
Yeah, it's hard because, you know, it's frustrating because every year I would like to do something for my birthday, and I always do something kind of small because it's such a tough time of the year. People are doing last-minute shopping, or they're traveling, or they're going home or whatever, and it's like, happy birthday to me, three people who are actually free to come out to the bar tonight. I'm not better.
You know what I did? So my daughter has a January birthday, and I was, like, so adamant about making it a thing and not, like, letting the holiday rush, like, get in the way of preparing for her birthday and, like, having it be a thing separate from Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, that we realized, like, we've really gone overboard. Like, every year, this is really bad. We've got to rein it in. She's spoiled freaking rotten. For, like, 4 straight months, she's, like, getting stuff from people.
So you both have kids?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're sort of me and my wife are still kind of on the fence because here's the thing. Kids can be really, really cool and funny and beautiful and rewarding. They can also be, like, insane and do
their
crazy
stuff.
Their total
time sucks, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's kind of nice to be able to be like, oh, hey, look at that cute baby. This is adorable. Let's play with the baby for 10 minutes. Okay, here's the baby back, and now I'm going to go home.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Like, I kind of like that system right now, so.
There are absolute pros and cons both ways.
Yeah.
And I do not begrudge anyone who decides, like, kids aren't for me, because I can totally see that. There are many days I'm like, man, I would really not like to get up and make a lunch for school this morning or whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is what it is.
I feel like we spent a lot of time on this show talking about how terrible it is having children. Have you noticed that?
Well, okay. It's also
just
very
be realistic. Yeah, they're
he
great.
He threw up in my car on Sunday. Technically, he threw up in Sean's car on Sunday.
They're
that.
Really great.
The point
he threw
is,
up in my car last weekend.
We were driving down the road, and he threw up all over the car. And bless his heart, he was sick. You know, you can't blame a kid for being sick. But, oh, God damn it still smells in that car. It's not okay.
When I
don't have kids,
younger,
Rob.
I was riding in the car with my friend and her kids. And her preschooler vomited pink vomit all over the back seat. And she was telling me, like, when I was pregnant, she's like, I seriously thought that in that moment, like, you were never going to have children after that. Like, it was just done. It was never going to happen. The look on your face was just like, nope. So, yeah. You get through it. I think we should get some listener questions, right? Because we just ate up like 43 minutes.
I know.
Guys.
We're not going to get to all
awesome.
The Rob fun facts, but yeah, let's do
okay.
it. Let's get our listener questions in.
Okay.
Johnny Gibbings wants
okay.
to know if you've. I feel like I'm going to translate this.
I'm going to translate
it from Johnny to what he really means. Johnny wants to know if you frequent Asian massage parlors, and I'm going to assume he wants to know if they're illegal.
Yeah, man, that was my favorite question out of all of them. So I wrote a story that was in Thuglet in issue number 5, and it was about two guys who were trying to knock off an Asian massage parlor. And no, I do not have any experience going to them. What I did find out is that there are message boards on the internet that are completely dedicated to this, where guys, like, review them in coded language to tell you what the girls do and don't do. You know, like, when they say accommodating, that means that they crank you at the end of the session. So it's like,
okay.
And yeah, and I fell into, like, this weird, like, black hole of, like, reading these websites, because it was, I sort of get fixated on these weird things and get so completely fascinated by them that I must have spent, like, a week, like, looking at these message boards. And I was like, because there was a story there and I was just looking for it. And, so, yeah, it's like I the story completely got built out of, like, these weirdos on the internet. And, you know, it was, man, the world is a scary place.
I'm going to tell you, though, I live in a military town, so there is, like, a lot of Asian massage parlors. I've never been inside of any of them. I don't know, okay? I have no idea. But I do remember when we first moved here, like, what the fuck is Okinawan massage? I've never heard of Okinawan massage. Like, I've heard of, you know, Thai and whatever. And then, like, we're sitting there, it's like, oh, okay. Okinawan massage is like, this is an Asian massage parlor, wink, wink. Because that's not a thing. Like, they don't have a special way, like, Okinawa. Okinawa is a fucking military base. So there's not a ton of, like, Japanese culture there. Anyway.
People are gross.
Yeah, people are gross.
So that's where that story came from.
It's creeping out.
Yeah. and just to be clear, too, the two guys trying to knock over the parlor completely fuck it up and lose in the end.
Hooray!
I do not like writing about exploiting women, and so it was important to me that the women actually turned the tables on them at the end of that story.
I feel like we should clap. That's exciting. Now I want to go read it.
And then the second question I think is going to be interesting to a lot of our listeners is you are one of the few who has landed an agent. How'd you do that?
lots of money and candy and begging. No, you know, it was funny. So, you know, my agent is Bri Ogden, who also works at Lit Reactor, and I had posted a story in the writer's workshop, and she read it. And we didn't know each other at this point, and she just sent me, like, a tweet or something. She was like, hey, I really liked your story. I'm like, oh, that's awesome that you would say that. Thank you. And then I self-published a novella called The Last Safe Place, and I went out to Portland for Wordstock because Lit Reactor got, like, a table and, like, threw a party and shit. And Bri was there, and she was like, hey, you know, your story was awesome. I read your novella. I really liked it. I'm like, that's so cool. I really like that you like the things that I write because you're an agent. And so when I finished my book, I honestly forget if she offered to look at it or if I asked her to look at it. But regardless, like, she ended up with the book. Mm-hmm. And I figured I had no expectations. I thought that she would read it and maybe she would give me some advice. Like, hey, you know, I know an agent who might like this. Or, hey, you know, you totally fucked this up and you need to fix it, dude. And then she sends me this message, like, a couple of weeks later. And she's like, listen, you know, I'm halfway through the story. And unless you completely fuck this up, I'm probably going to offer to represent you. So if you want to have options, you should really start querying now. Which was a very nice and generous thing for her to say.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and I was like, look, you know, Bri is fucking brilliant. She is super hardcore. She's tough. We were totally simpatico, you know, on our tastes, on our attitudes. You know, we had a good working relationship up until then. So I was like, I literally see no reason, you know, if she believes in this, then I want to be with her. And yeah, it was great. You know, we were on submission for about 10 months and then the book got picked up, which felt really, really nice.
May I ask you a personal question?
Yeah, of course.
Oh.
Did you lose weight or gain weight in those 10 months?
Oh, Christ. I don't know. I sort of yo-yo a little bit because I have one of my discs in my back is all fucked up. So I will very, like, steadily go to the gym. And when I'm going to the gym, I'll eat well because I feel like I need to, like, capitalize on what I'm doing. But
right.
Then, like, my back will spasm and, like, I'll miss a couple of weeks and then I'll get, like, angry at myself and then I'll start eating, like, crappy food, because I have, like, literally no common sense. And
right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's sort of, I can't say that there was any appreciable loss or gain that could be attributed to being on submission.
I was going to say that.
It fucking sucked. I hate it.
Yeah, I feel like that's true. No, I don't have any experience with that whatsoever at the moment, but I feel like you're being honest.
I will tell you, having a short story submission out for a long time drives me bananas.
I will tell you exactly what encapsulates it. I'll be at work, and I would be at my desk, and I've got my email open, and I've got my cell phone next to me, and I'm typing away, and I have to go to the bathroom. So I go upstairs, and I pee, and I come back down, and the first thing I do is look at my email and my phone to see if Bri tried to get in contact with me. For 10 straight months, you feel like that. Like, it's like any moment this could happen. And worse is you start, like, it starts fucking with your head because you're like, okay, I know I'm out at these houses and I've been out for X number of weeks. They have to have read it by now. So if they have read it, then I haven't gotten a rejection yet, which means maybe they brought it back to all the other editors. You just, like, I was a complete basket case, but I also have, like, the impulse control of a toddler. So, I mean, you know, that's sort of expected for someone like me.
Yeah.
It's a long, frustrating process. And, you know, it's weird because, you know, there was a house that I was out at that I was sure was going to take the book. Like, I knew the editor, smart guy, like, our case line up. Like,
I think it's funny that you're like, he's smart, so obviously he was going to take it.
Yeah. I was like, this is the one.
Yeah.
And he shot, and he rejected it. And his reasons for rejecting it were fair. And, you know, I was completely fucking bereft. And I came home and I got in bed. And I was like, man, I fucking hate doing this. And you know, I'm blessed with an amazing wife who was like, you know, stop it and get over your bullshit and get back to work. and it's so easy to get caught up in that. It's like every rejection sort of feels like, man, fuck, that was my last chance. And it's just really that, you know, it's such a long process. And especially for people who are sort of generally impatient like I am, it's hard. But it's important to sort of maintain some level of decorum and some level of calmness throughout it. Because eventually it will pay off. I mean, if you keep on working at it and it really matters to you, eventually you're going to find that person who wants to be your champion. It's just a matter of finding the person, which sometimes
right.
can take a while.
So Chris Irvin had a question for you. Part of it I didn't even understand, but I'll say it anyway. One of them is about your podcast, the Lit Reactor podcast, which is unprintable, and he asked if that's coming back. So give us a little about that. And also he said, I don't even know the inflections to use. What's Rob's go-to Titan load to smash on noobs? I don't know what that
is. Oh,
means.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll answer the first, then explain the second. First
okay.
is I don't know what the fuck is going on with the podcast. The hard thing is because so it's me, Josh, and Kath. Kath lives in Norway, so it's really hard to coordinate the schedules. And we also we tried a new recording setup with someone, and then the fucking recording shit to bed, and then I felt like an asshole, and so it turned into this whole thing, and it made me really sad. It's more of an issue of us actually finding the time. We're trying to because it's fun, but. Yeah, I do not have a firm return date for that. For the
load. Well, we can relate to that. There's a reason we do this on Wednesday, which seems like a weird night to choose to get drunk. But it's because it's literally the only night that, especially when we had Dakota, there's three of us. It's the only night that all three of us get together. We were in three different time zones. And that wasn't one
yeah.
of the country. I know our first episode was with Andrew Bergen, who was in Andres Bergen, who was in Japan, and I was the only one who made it.
Well, see, this kind of works for me because I would have been drinking anyway, and it's at the end of the day, so I'm already in my pajamas and I'm pretty comfortable. So, yeah, it's good. The Titan loadouts is when you're playing Titanfall, you get to choose your loadouts are basically what weapons you start your match with. I actually don't spend a lot of time in my Titan. I like to fight on foot. You know, I like to use my Titan as a walking guard. So I like the smart pistol, and that is my go-to weapon. Also, the arc grenades. I am awesome with the arc grenades. I was playing the other day and threw the grenade and knocked this guy off the balcony and then shot him in the face.
That's a Titan.
Those are all things that makes
is that like a robot?
Yeah. You know, there's something really viscerally satisfying about the conceit of the game. I don't know what the fuck it's about. It's you're a fucking space marine or something stupid, and you're running around fighting people. And then when your Titan is ready, you can hit a button, and all of a sudden this robot comes crashing down from the sky and lands on the ground. And you can either climb inside and start blowing people up, or you can set it to guard mode, and it'll follow you around and shoot the people who are trying to kill you. And I tend to set it to guard mode because I really want to get really good at fighting on foot before I get really good at fighting inside the Titan. But man, when you're pinned down by enemy fire and it's oh man, this is a bad situation. Oh wait, hold on, let me call my giant robot that will fucking kill everyone. It's like a game that was designed for me personally.
So, 'cause you just basically always wanted to be a space marine.
I always wanted to have a giant robot with which to stomp on things.
Okay. I can relate to that. Sometimes when I'm stuck in traffic, I still want a giant robot to stomp on things.
Yep.
So we're really short on time, and I turn things over to Jessica for a minute. She's got some stuff that needs to be discussed.
Okay.
We have mutual news. So Books and Booze is doing a live event. We're actually doing two live events this year because Renee and I could not get together, sadly enough. So we decided to just split our efforts. She's doing an event in California later in the year. I'm doing an event in June in Louisville, Kentucky. And you're going to be one of our guests.
I am totally going to be one of your guests. Thank you so much for inviting me to that. by the way. That is like, I'm really excited. I think this is going to be a lot of fun.
I would add, you're going.
I would add that Rob
has got to be forever far away. Go ahead.
Forever far away. Rob's going to be like the greatest live reader ever, and I don't like. I've never seen you read, but I heard that you did a reading, and at the reading, the story you read was accepted to a publication by a guy in the audience.
Yeah,
like that's pretty amazing. Like.
Well, no, it was funny. So it's North at the Bar, and Todd Robinson is one of the people who runs it in New York, and he runs Thuglit, and we were bullshitting, and I was talking about the story, and I'm like, yeah, you know, I've been really sweating it for the last week, but I think it's done, and, you know, I think maybe I'll send it out. He's like, well, you know where to find me. I'm like, you're about to hear it in 5 minutes, motherfucker. Tell me if you're interested or not. So I get up and I read the story, and it got a really good reaction. And, like, as soon as I'm done with the story, he gets up to the mic, and he's like, and that'll be in Thuglit issue 12. And I'm like, fuck, man, that's awesome.
I would feel weird, though, like, if you've discussed the story with someone or whatever, and then they're like, well, let me see something of yours, or let me see that. I feel like, oh, my God, what if they think it's terrible?
Yeah.
But that didn't happen. But
I mean, Todd has published me in Thuglit twice already, so he knows my style, and I sort of understand like what is gonna sort of like light him on fire. So I thought the story would appeal to him, but as I'm reading it, I'm trying to get out of the habit. I hate reading out of New York. I did Nora at the Bar in Baltimore and read like half the first chapter and really, really, really didn't like it because it's not structured to be read in like one installment. Like, I don't like having to stand there and be like, okay, so you understand this guy's doing this and this guy's doing that and this is where we find them.
You know,
I'd rather just write
the best way to deal with that
just
is
like, what's that?
When I went to North Bar, Los Angeles, Eric Buettner read from one of his books, and what he did is he read the first sentence of every chapter. It was like 33 chapters or something like that. And it was so fucking cool. I was like, I have to own that book. I have to have it right now. That was amazing. Mind blown. It was.
I'm going to pretend that you didn't say that, and I'm going to steal that idea. Thank
you go
God
right
there's
ahead.
No record of this conversation.
But
yeah, like I knew Todd was digging the story when like he was sitting up toward the front. He was laughing his ass off because I sort of specifically I think that I'm gonna read this in Louisville because it got a good reaction from the audience, and he was just like losing his shit laughing. So I'm like, yeah, I think Todd will like this one.
That's definitely it. Yeah,
yeah.
The venue that we're going to have our event at, it's called Groucho's Bar and Karaoke, and the owner of the bar is Groucho. Like, that's his name. That's who I've been trying to get in touch with and get all these details nailed down over the internet. Very exciting. He's opening it up 2 hours earlier than normal for us so that we don't have to compete with the karaokeers, and then I promised him we would stay and still sing afterwards. So it's destined to be a fantastic event, and so excited you signed on for that. And so, hooray!
Yeah, I'm excited that you would think of me for that. And you know, I've never been to Louisville, and you know, I love what you girls do with Books and Booze, and I really, you know, I like Patrick Wensink a lot, who you had said you were going after as well. And I was like, yeah, this all kind of makes sense together. I think this will be good.
It's gonna be amazing.
it sounds like it's going to be pretty effing good.
Once I get that, like, my readers are nailed down, my venue's nailed down, okay, I'm just excited now. I don't even care anymore. I don't have to worry about anything. So this is going to be a good time. I'm very excited. Thank you for doing that. Okay.
I still have to worry about
everything
but the location. So, you know, good for you and everything, Jessica.
Well, you've got August 4. Move it along.
No, it's good. Me and Leah Ryan, because she's coming into town, we both booked the same hotel, which is good. Cause,
I also,
you know, that way we're sort of centralized in one place.
She told me about that, Leah did, and so I sent that hotel information on to Amanda Gowan, who's also going to be there. I said, in case you're looking for a place. And
oh, yeah. The La Quinta by the
airport. Carpool ride, et cetera. So we're probably all going to be staying there. Expect
that's
locks
cool,
on your
though.
Door.
That was the best thing about St. Louis. What's
selfish? It's a little selfish to pick the airport hotel, but it was cheap, which appeals to me on a variety of
levels.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah. No, I have to fly to Maryland in July, and I definitely airport hotel all the way.
Mm-hmm. Good time.
Way to do it. All right, so we are like way over right now, and I still have to say High Octane Damnation once again. Been compared to Christine. It's got boobs, blood, and cars. I think guns. We've been talking about it a lot the last several weeks, and this is the last week that Brett Williams' High Octane Damnation is sponsoring us. So click the banner, check it out. It's available through Comet Press. It sounds like a good grindhousey, pulpy, fun little ride. So yeah, check it out, see what it's all about, and if you're digging it, buy it. As always, click the links. We're going to have a link. Is New York is available for pre-order, right?
It has a pre-order page that just has the paperback edition available. So kind of, yeah, but if someone wants to go to my website, which is robwhart.com, they can follow me on Twitter or Facebook or my newsletter or whatever, and I'll tell people when it's going to be available.
Woohoo.
Cool. And then last but not least, music this week is by a band called Avlov from Newton, Connecticut, and their song is called There's My Deenie. I listened to it earlier. It sounds pretty cool.
Avlov,
I don't know what,
spelled backwards.
Yes, it is. Danielle and I wondered, like, if that was on purpose or what it could possibly mean. We don't have the answers, but, you know.
If that's not on purpose, I think I would be a little upset.
Right? Like, why isn't it on purpose?
Like you missed a really good opportunity here to make me laugh.
Yeah.
Right.
Hmm.
So, yeah, that's the show, and we're going to be back next week with someone. I didn't look. Who's next week?
God damn it, I knew you were going to ask me that. I don't have it pulled up.
I don't have a problem.
Oh, no, I do. It's Juliet Escoria, right?
Sure. That sounds right to me. If it's not, I'll just edit this part out later. but yeah, Rob, thanks so much. This was tons of fun. It's not
good.
Often that we get to have a lot of fun and get really deep. Usually we only get to do one or the other.
Yeah, you know, I have a bad habit of doing that, especially when I'm drinking. Because, again, I'm mostly full of shit. Thank you so much for having me on. This was a blast. Yeah, and seriously, it's an honor to be asked, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, well, it's an honor to be one of the first people to read the book, and it's a great book, and I totally recommend it. We're going to link that up, and we'll also link up Thuglet 5, because wasn't that mentioned last week as well, or the week before?
Yes.
That story is getting quite the following, so we're going to link that up so people can check it out. And,
well, I remember because Chris brought up the other story I had in Thuglet that was about bagels.
Oh yes, that's
yeah,
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like bagels.
Yeah, the bagel story. I like that one a lot. That's a fun one. That's me actually being slightly more serious than normal, because usually like the crime shorts that I write are a little like violent and over the top and silly, and this was one where I was like, I want to write one where I'm not being a jackass. So, yeah.
Just experiment with not being a jackass just this once.
Yeah. You know, you got to be serious every now and again.
So, yeah, that's the show.